I think the first point I want to make is that we should celebrate the fact that we're having this discussion today in March of 2008 and not in spring of 2007 or in spring of 2006. It is absolutely remarkable that it has now been 2 years and 2 months since Hamas emerged as victorious in legislative elections in January 2006. And throughout that time, the international coalition on how to approach Hamas, the international coalition has stayed, I would say, remarkably firm. I don't think there is anybody in this room, myself included, who would have said, and I said it from this platform 2 years ago because I know I was wrong, who would have predicted that 2+ years later, all the key players in the quartet and virtually all the major players in the international stage would have held firm 2 years later to requirements for diplomatic engagement with Hamas. Those requirements being the quartet conditions, renunciation of terrorism, recognizing Israel's right to exist, and participating in diplomacy as a means to achieve political ends. So I think we should first all pause and recognize, in fact, what has been accomplished in the last 2 years on this vital issue. Secondly, I think it's important at the outset to identify what a debate about Hamas is not about. It is not about the very narrow question of having low-level intelligence contacts with a group. The United States and other international actors have had low-level intelligence-related contacts with some of the most heinous groups that go back decades. We certainly had contacts with the PLO years and years before there was a discussion of having diplomatic engagement with the PLO. This is also not a question over the narrow issue of prisoner exchanges. Warring parties have prisoner exchanges that don't bespeak diplomatic engagement. I'll give you a Middle East example. The Israelis, of course, released hundreds of Ahmed Jibril and George Habash fighters, and nobody suggested that that prisoner release presaged diplomatic engagement with Ahmed Jibril or George Habash. We're not talking about what is involved in the narrow question of what might occur with Gilad Shalit. We're not talking about having CIA or other men on the ground talking to people in Gaza to gather information or to have a very tactical discussion. I think the issue really comes down to the sort of question that Sean McCormick put on the State Department blog not too long ago, which is the appropriate strategy to advance the peace process, one in which Hamas is a party with whom we engage, with whom international partners engage, or a party that is outside the process? Is Hamas part of the solution or part of the problem? And is there a zero sum? And some people will, of course, come back and say, well, it's both, of course, part of the solution and part of the problem. The real question is it a zero sum? Now, we've seen some interesting developments on this. The Foreign Minister of Italy, Massimo D'Alema, Jonathan Powell, Tony Blair's former close advisor, Ephraim Halevi, former head of the Mossad in Israel, some prominent Americans, such as Brent Scowcroft, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Colin Powell, all have advocated engagement with Hamas of various forms and various degrees. It is only now, 2+ years after Hamas's election, it is only now that it's beginning to become part of a U.S. policy debate. I think we've seen this movie before. We saw this movie in the mid-80s, the early mid-80s, regarding the PLO. And it was It is not surprising that this is part of the policy debate. It is surprising, in fact, that it took this long for it to become part of the policy debate. I think we even heard a faint echo of some of the views inside the seventh floor in the words of an unnamed senior administration official quoted a couple of days ago, who, for castigating Israel for its policy toward Gaza, when this administration official, whose quotes were interspersed with the Secretary of State, so you can define for yourself who the senior administration official was, when this administration official castigated Israel for taking steps that have the effect of strengthening Hamas, with the implicit message being, in my reading, that if Israel is going to strengthen Hamas, then we Americans aren't going to be the last suckers in the room. We aren't going to be the last people to deal with Hamas. I read this, I thought it was a bit rich, given the U.S. role in helping Hamas in the legislative elections in January 2006, to begin with. Now, in the world of advocacy on behalf of the question of engagement with Hamas, there are basically two camps. On the one side, there's the camp that says, we need to find a way to deal with Hamas so as to strengthen Abbas and to advance the Annapolis process. That dealing with Hamas is instrumental. Dealing with Hamas is really a way to achieve what we have long sought to achieve, which is in progress between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. I'll go into that more in a moment. But that's one camp. There's another camp which says, we need to deal with Hamas because they are the wave of the future, because they represent real political power, because they have popular support, popular legitimacy. These are two very different views. One, I think, is more candid in their approach. The other is more serpentine, subtle in their approach. Let me go into this in more detail. The Annapolis camp, the camp that argues that we need to work with Hamas because only by engaging Hamas in some way, perhaps by disarming Hamas, perhaps by giving Hamas a piece of the pie, we have to recreate Mecca because Mecca strengthens Abbas. We need a ceasefire, because only in a ceasefire can negotiations take place. We need to get Fatah back to the crossings, because once we can have Fatah men on the border between Gaza and Egypt, they will have a foothold from which to eventually build their strength, and I suppose the argument goes, to reclaim control of Gaza. And then all of this is really in the larger framework, which says, for us to make progress, to assist Israelis and Palestinians to make progress, Palestinians must be reconciled. Palestinians must be united. And in disunity, there cannot be progress. That's the fundamental argument of those who say that that finding a way to incorporate Hamas into the process is prerequisite to progress in the Annapolis process. It's the argument that in disunity, there will never be progress. I will say, just on that last point, I think this is especially condescending and pernicious. There is historically a very clear choice between unity or progress. One only has to look at the Zionist experience and the choice between unity or progress, historically or even very recently. We have no compunction looking at the Israeli political system and having Israelis vote in the Knesset 61-59 for fundamental accords about the nature of the state and its relations with its partners and the size of the country, accords which rend society from top to bottom. And we have no compunction of having this sort of disunity as a fundamental element of progress. But when the same question is applied to Palestinians, the alternative is argued, that only unity can bring us progress. And I would argue that this is a fundamental flaw, a fundamental problem in the argument in favor of engagement. There's another point of view, which is the second argument, which is has nothing to do with Annapolis and nothing to do with Abbas. And this argument says that we need to deal with Hamas because they're in power, because they are powerful and they are popular. They can't be wished away. Now, interestingly, this perspective reflects a certain respect for Hamas's, how do I put it, barbarity. Not necessarily for their popularity. You didn't really hear this much after January 2006. The coalition stayed firm. It wasn't because Hamas was necessarily elected. And it wasn't because Hamas resorted to terror. Hamas has resorted to terror from its onset. It was really because the nihilism of Hamas reached a level, reached a depth that it hadn't reached before. And it's an interesting comment that at a certain level of terrorism, a group goes from being unacceptable to a necessary partner. I don't want to say preferred partner, because it's definitely not preferred, and nobody wants Hamas to be a partner. But at a certain level of barbarity, the argument goes, they must be accommodated. Now, it's very interesting to compare and contrast the debate about Hamas today and the debate about the PLO several years ago. What I think is interesting about the Hamas debate is that nobody really argues that there's a moderate wing. Nobody really argues that Hamas is a two-state solution only waiting to happen. If you look at the debate about the PLO 20 years ago, there the debate was between one state and two state elements in the PLO. Today, the debate about Hamas is very different. It's a debate between advocates of a tahdiya, a lull, a pause for regrouping, and a hudna, an armistice, a longer understanding, a longer pause, a longer lull, the difference between a pause and an armistice. It's a very different, I would say fundamentally different debate than the debate that we saw 20 years ago played out inside the PLO between one state and two state. A debate which in some quarters still rages, of course, don't get me wrong. That debate is not fully settled, but at least it's a vigorous debate. I would say that we're quite hard pressed to find that debate anywhere in Hamas. The debate is really all tactics, lull versus armistice. And it goes really to the heart of what Hamas is vis-a-vis the PLO. And, you know, I hate to take up a moment or two, but it behooves us to remind ourselves the type of organizations that we're dealing with. The PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization. For better or for worse, the debate was to liberate. It was a positive agenda. The debate inside the organization was liberating what? All of Palestine or part of Palestine? As I said earlier, the debate rages. Hamas is very different. Hamas is the Islamic resistance movement. It is Haraka al-Mukawama al-Islamiyya. It is A, not necessarily about Palestine, and B, totally about resistance. It is not about liberation. It is not about statehood. It is not about independence. It is about resistance. And that basic concept suffuses all that Hamas is about. And unless we understand the fundamental difference, this difference between taqdiyah and hudna on one hand and one state and two state on the other, then we will never understand what Hamas is really seeking. The bottom line is, it seems to me, that those who advocate for engagement with Hamas as a sine qua non of progress in the peace process believe that Hamas will be a participant in its own destruction. believe that Hamas will willingly participate in a process that will lead to its own disenfranchisement and disempowerment. This, it seems to me, is folly. Hamas actually has a very good sense of what it wants to achieve, a very clear sense of what it wants to achieve, has made significant progress toward that. It narrows the debate quite well from its perspective. It has compelled the world to accept that the debate is over Hudna versus Tahdiya, rather than anything that resembles a contribution toward regional peace and security that might benefit either Israel or wider U.S. interests. This makes the Hamas-Israel conflict very different than, say, the Northern Ireland conflict, which prompted Mr. Powell to suggest that based on his experience, one has to deal with all sides. The Northern Ireland conflict was a resolvable conflict. It was not about the existence of Great Britain. It was about the presence in Northern Ireland. And which also suggests that if a new Venice declaration that one could imagine Mr. Massimo arguing for in Italy would be an even further step backward than the original Venice declaration was in 1975. Now, a certain argument, one can imagine an argument being made in favor of engagement with Hamas if the Palestinian Authority didn't exist. If Hamas was the only game in town, we would still have this debate. I would probably argue against it. But one can imagine a reasonable position being held that if indeed Hamas was the only game in town, that they represented the only Palestinian perspective, that one should find a way to incorporate them in the diplomatic engagement. But that isn't the case. And what makes the current debate so problematic is that there are alternatives, imperfect as they are. Why we would bless a process that requires less of Hamas in 2008 than we required of the PLO 20 years ago, to me, is ludicrous. It would only confirm our weakness and irresolution and confirm to Hamas the narrative of their inevitable success. So, we're left with the question, what to do? It's a very practical question. Now, I'll offer a few points. First, I think we should recognize that peacemaking is hard and will take time. I mean, it sounds tautological, sounds obvious, but every 6 weeks, it seems, there is a new strategy that emerges, whether from this office in the administration or that diplomat or this think tank. Sometimes it's the Syria track. Let's go there. That will unravel this. Then it's, no, the roadmap, step by step, incremental. Then it's, no, we'll go for a shelf agreement. We'll get the final deal done and then work backwards. Every 6 weeks, 3 months, there's a totally new strategy. I think this is self-defeating, undermines ourselves, undermines our position, and certainly undermines the view that others in the region have regarding the United States. Second, I think we should have confidence in our strategy. I think the basic strategy that was adopted after the Hamas victory in January 2006 still remains the appropriate strategy. Namely, do what we can to invest in that the West Bank is a successful alternative. In the meantime, continue to try to isolate Gaza from the West Bank, and through this process, eventually to bring about a change in the dynamic inside Gaza so that Hamas loses whatever popular support it has. Now, this was the approach up until Annapolis. Now, at Annapolis, something very strange happened. I will say, in my view, Annapolis was a tragedy. Not that the event was held, but what emerged from the event in the following sense. There were three elements of peacemaking. One, Palestinian capacity building, represented by Tony Blair. Two, Palestinian security infrastructure building, represented by the slew of American generals. And three, the diplomacy. From Annapolis to President Bush's trip to the Middle East in January, the United States, in my view, totally rejiggered this process, cut the legs out from under the two most important elements of this triad, namely capacity building and security building, and instead put the full faith and credit in the United States in the pursuit of a diplomatic engagement to achieve some sort of agreement before the end of this term. We can't do all three at the same time. It cannot be done. There is an order here. There are priorities to achieve. Just this week, General Fraser, after convening the first session between Israelis and Palestinians to assess progress on the roadmap, itself long overdue, said that even with the full effort of two sides, it would be 1 to 2 years to implement phase one of the roadmap. And yet, in my view, the administration made a very serious mistake by undermining that process and B, the Tony Blair capacity building process by putting so much emphasis on the diplomacy. Creating a deadline was a mistake. It's as much of a mistake in Iraq as it is here with the Israelis and Palestinians. And I think we are now reaping the results of that mistake. So one, recognize problems will take time. Two, have confidence in our strategy. Three, we should have persisted in the strategy that we had, imperfectly implemented as it was. We should have persisted in that strategy that we had before Annapolis. And four, we need to know that not all problems have neat solutions. Maybe the Israelis are going to take a slice of northern Gaza as a security belt. It will not be a strategic solution to the problem of the rockets. And I think everybody recognizes that. But it will purchase some time. And it is probably better than some of the other options. Now, if we learned one thing from the PLO experience from the late 1980s, when the United States engaged diplomatically with the PLO before the PLO met Israel's requirements, if we learn one thing, is that that order was backwards. That it was only when the PLO met Israel's diplomatic requirements was there real engagement for peacemaking. And indeed, I would argue that the period from 88 to 92, 93 was a lost period precisely because we had the process in the wrong order. We're now in that moment again. Will we, I mean the collective we, the quartet international actors, begin to engage diplomatically, begin to engage more than functionally with Hamas as a potential partner in this process? And I would argue that if we do this before Hamas reaches an understanding on Israel's conditions for engagement, then we'll be making the same mistake. I would not be surprised if the Israelis have their own reactions. I would not be surprised if the Israelis, for example, sever their own lingering links to Gaza. If the Israelis formally declare that 242 has been implemented vis-a-vis Gaza and end the customs union and thrust Gaza solely into the orbit of Egypt. Alternatively, I would not be surprised if the Israelis formally declare that their commitment to the territorial unity of the Gaza and West Bank is no more, a commitment that Israel made in previous agreements. But clearly, if Gaza is run by one regime and the West Bank is run by another regime, one would imagine that Israel is within its rights to suggest that any commitment has already been abrogated by the Palestinian side. I would urge us not to go down this path, because I think the ramifications of this path are much wider than we even think already. The ultimate decision is Israel's, They're the ones that will bear the burden. I would hope that all those partners that I mentioned at the beginning, the Italian foreign minister, former British officials, etc., would recognize the right order to proceed and the right recognition of the stakes. Let me just quote at the end two Israelis whose peacemaking credentials on these issues one would imagine are pretty impeccable. They are not men of the right. If anything, they're men of the left, or certainly center-left. Amnon Shachak and Ephraim Sneh. Amnon Shachak's suggestion in the current environment: target Hamas leaders. Take them out one by one. Ephraim Sneh, quote, "There can be no diplomatic solution without wiping out Hamas," end quote. There is a debate going on in Israel, to be sure, but it is not a debate along the lines that have been postulated on the State Department website. It's really a debate as to whether, even under any conceivable scenario, Hamas can be allowed to stay, not should Hamas be brought in from the cold. Thank you.